Welcome to the Little Red Podcast, which brings you China from beyond the Beijing Beltway. I'm Graham Smith from the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University, and I'm joined by my co-host Louisa Lim, former China correspondent for the BBC and NPR, now with the Centre for Advancing Journalism at Melbourne University. We're on air thanks to support from the Australian Centre for China in the World.
October the 1st, it was the 70th birthday of the People's Republic of China, and that moment played out as if on a split screen. In Beijing, President Xi Jinping inspected a massive parade of troops. In Hong Kong, it was protesters parading through the streets in unauthorized marches. By night, in Beijing, heart-shaped fireworks exploded over Tiananmen Square. Down south, firebombs and tear gas were exploding in districts across Hong Kong. I was in Hong Kong over National Day, and I'm going to bring you voices straight from the streets, including me interviewing someone in a gas mask, so apologies for any dodgy sound.
Police fired 6 live rounds of ammunition, hitting an 18-year-old in the chest. They also fired 1,400 rounds of tear gas, 900 rubber bullets, 190 beanbag rounds. What now for the movement? Today we're going to hear voices from inside the movement, as well as activist Wong Yik Mo, legislator Fernando Chung, and scholar Brian Fong from the Education University of Hong Kong. Louisa, you were there on the streets yesterday. Could you describe the scene for us?
Yeah, Graham. Well, it started off very peacefully, and in fact, marches were taking place in 7 different locations across the island, and in the new territories as well. And I was on Hong Kong Island, and it was interesting because these marches were not authorized. So just by taking part, you were taking part in an illegal gathering. They were also very hard to get to because the transport network had been shut down. And the police had warned people that it was very, very dangerous to attend and said not to go. But still, these sort of huge numbers of people turned out, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands in total, but there's really no figure for the number of attendees. When I was there, I bumped into the former convener of the Civil Human Rights Front, Wong Yik Mo. So that's the platform that has really organized these mass marches. And he had just stepped down that day, his term had ended. So I started by asking him how he thought the movement had changed.
I think in this movement, Civil Human Rights Front, we kind of play that leader role in a way, you know. Although we know this is a leaderless movement, and we don't claim ourselves to be the leader, but then we do organize demonstrations, and still people can take to the street with us. We don't know. I've been asked this question very frequently. And I would say either we lose or win, you know. One side is going to win. You know, the police, they are doing everything for themselves. It's not for the government, it's not for Beijing. Because they've broken so many laws and rules. And if they lose, they will have very serious consequences. And they don't care if they've done wrong things. It's for themselves, you know. People are selfish. And that's why they need to win. So the same applies to us. If we lose, the police will stay the same as now, or even worse. And that's why we can never surrender. We don't know when this will end. We only see tomorrow, maybe a week ahead, and that's it. Demonstrations that we plan, for example, 28th of September, for example, this. And for the rest, we leave it for the public to, you know, to improvise. But at the same time, we do provide some support.
So the public is moving faster in a way than the Civil Human Rights Fund, right?
I think so. I totally agree with that.
I mean, that's why it's become a nationalistic movement, right?
Yeah.
It's something that's just happened.
And it's very democratic. you know, people can have their say.
But then that makes it harder for Beijing, because there's not only is this this new demand, but it's not a voice demand, and there's no one to discuss it with.
Well, this is not a new demand. We only want free election. Well, you know, you give us free election, the rest we will improvise. You don't have to worry about it.
But if they turn around and said, okay, well, they're never going to turn around and say you can have free elections. It's just not going to happen, is it?
But you know, nobody expected Berlin Wall to fall. You don't know when it's going to happen. Nobody expected the Soviet Union to fall. We know it's going to be very tough. We hope that something's going to change.
So, Louisa, you were out there the whole time. I mean, when did it sort of the mood change? When did it feel that things had started to go wrong?
It was really hard to tell. I mean, things just change on a dime. At one minute, everything was perfectly peaceful, and I literally went to get some bubble tea, and when I came back, there was tear gas in the air, and then I turned around and there were just huge quantities of riot police moving down the street, and they were tear gassing in front of us. I was with a whole pile of reporters. We followed them down the street all the way, and they were just lobbing so much tear gas. And it was interesting because there weren't really any protesters there. The protesters follow this Bruce Lee-inspired strategy of be water, which is just kind of dispersing really fast. They'd all just kind of disappeared. And later on, I found out that many of them had been, especially in Wanchai, had been pulled into shops and houses by people who just saved them from the police, because the police were really very brutal. They were grabbing people, they were arresting people, they were grabbing people and tying their arms behind their back and picking them up by their arms. And, you know, I myself was there when I saw there was a man who was just kind of standing beside us. Police tried to arrest him for no particular reason, and the journalists, we all moved in to see what was happening, and they swung guns right in the face of journalists, point blank. They were aiming guns at the journalists. And quite a few journalists have been injured, dozens, in fact. One got shot in the leg, several people got head injuries, and in fact, two quite major news organizations ended up taking their journalists off the streets because it was just considered so dangerous. The mood was really nasty, and as we followed the riot police down the streets, I bumped into a legislator, Fernando Cheung, who's a pan-democrat. He'd lost his voice, I think, from just taking in so much of the tear gas. He was coughing and spluttering a bit because of the tear gas in the air. I asked him how he would characterise the police behaviour that day.
They behave like fucks. They are not disciplined. They're supposed to be a disciplined force, but they behave like fucks. They push their ways around. I lost my voice, I'm sorry. I can't speak.
I'm seeing a report that a protester got shot in the chest. Did you see that?
Yeah, I heard. I heard, yes.
How will this end?
There's really no end to it. Because the government has to answer the five demands. And unless the five demands answer, there's no end to it.
So you think even if people are being killed, this will continue?
It will breed more hatred. More people will come up.
That was Fernando Cheung, Vice Chairman of the Labour Party and member of the LegCo. What's the mood today, the day after?
Oh, the mood is just bitter anger, rage, I would say. This morning was the biggest mass trial in post-handover Hong Kong. 96 people were being charged with rioting. And so I went to the courtroom where that was happening just to get a sense of the mood. And, you know, it was very chaotic, actually. While I watched, they had to adjourn the trial because a lot of them had not had a chance to even see lawyers that morning. And they had been taken in on the 29th of September. There were lots of people outside protesting. And they were carrying, a lot of them were very young. There were secondary school students. and young professionals as well, and they carried signs saying things like, "We did nothing wrong, we will not be cowed." And there was another one I saw which said, "Dissolve the murder machine, give us justice or give us death." And people were angry, they were defiant. And those who I talked to said that on the online notice boards where the movement talks, all the discussion today was about how to change tactics and whether the movement should be more violent, given the amount of violence meted out to them. Here are some voices.
To support those who arrested on the 29th?
2 days ago.
Yeah. Do you know them?
We don't know them.
Oh, you don't know any of them?
Yes. Yeah.
What happened yesterday, the behaviour of the police yesterday, does that change anything for you?
I think it didn't change my mind or my attitude towards the police, but I believed it changed most of the Hong Kong people, the thoughts of the police, or the behavior is coming, another behavior, maybe like beating them back or not that peaceful, I mean, of our behavior.
What you're saying is the protest movement might have entered a new stage which might be more violent?
Yes.
And you would be okay with that?
I'm very okay with that, yeah. Because at the beginning stage, I think most of the media or the international media, they think we are so peaceful about the protest, right? But right now, because of the over-violence of the police, yeah, and the overpower of them. So I believe many Hong Kong people, they will support and they will join our protests, even with more violence.
I mean, the police has overwhelming force on its side. They have guns, they have tear gas, they have water cannons. And what we have seen is the protest movement has umbrellas. It has bottles, it has Molotov cocktails. Mm. It's in no way equipped. And if it fights back, then it will just lead to more injuries and more deaths.
But I think Hong Kong people transforming, they are not afraid. I don't know, maybe there will be no equipment to against the police, but our heart, we have the faith. Actually, I know it is not physically can be against the police. We will get hurt or something like this, but we don't afraid.
But what about the moral higher ground? I mean, in the past, particularly at the beginning, before the movement was setting on fires and defacing things, in a way it had the moral higher ground because it could say that it was peaceful. Now that's no longer possible.
The police to make us that violent? Is the police to break our moral? Yeah, so what we can do is just to fight them back, no matter peacefully or violently, because it's now or never. We don't have another chance.
Some of my friends are arrested by the police and they might be in jail for a few months or 10 years. I don't know, so I'm here to support them.
How many people do you know who are involved in today's case?
I know two of my friends and some, they're all my friends. You know, 97 people today are in court, but yeah, they're all my brothers and families, so I'm here to support them.
So the two people that you know, how do you know them?
They're my friends.
Are you a student?
I'm a student.
How old are you?
I'm 19.
Were you there when they were caught?
I am there, yeah.
You were there?
Yeah.
So it could have been you?
Yeah. I can't help them. I can't save them. So I watched them arrest them.
So that was only a couple of days ago, right? It was like 3 days ago.
29th of September.
And given what has happened since then and the behavior of the police last night, how do you think that has changed the way that you feel about the movement?
I never changed about my feeling of this protesting, because we are all against China, against the Hong Kong government, and I think what they've done, we won't regret it, and we sacrifice everything to save this, to save our home. And I think the brothers, my families in the court won't regret anything of this protest.
What you're saying is, even if you yourself had also been innocent,
even if myself, I would have been arrested if I, yeah, I would have been arrested, but I won't regret anything, because we are willing to do this to protect Hong Kong.
It's a big price though, 10 years.
We'd rather die to have freedom, to live for freedom and not living in China. You know, we just hate the Hong Kong government, and we just won't live it without freedom, you know. People won't live under Hong Kong government.
Oh, those are students from the school opposite, a primary school opposite, who are shouting five demands, not one less. And I mean, do you agree with him? Do you also have friends who are there?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's two of my friends, and I think that 97 people were in this course. It's all my friend and my family. It's all our brother and sister.
Has what happened yesterday changed anything for you?
No. It's never changed my mind and my feeling of this about the freedom.
But the cost of protesting is getting higher and higher. Yesterday we saw just how dangerous it is. I mean, dangerous because the chance
after this protest, Hong Kong will ever go back to normal, because our protester, this generation of people, will not forgive Hong Kong government and Hong Kong police anymore. So it will never be normal anymore. Because, you know, if this protest is over and we think we go back to normal, but it's not. We never forgive Hong Kong government, and we just go to school and work like normally, but deep down we know we wouldn't accept, as we are a Chinese. This generation of people won't accept.
You're saying this generation of people is lost to Beijing?
Yeah.
You agree?
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much for your time.
So, I mean, this isn't your first time in Hong Kong. What do you feel has changed about the movement since you were there last?
Oh, I think it's really coalesced. It has a much stronger sense of identity and a sense of Hong Kong identity. And one thing that's really caused that is this new, they're calling it a national anthem called Glory to Hong Kong. And this was written in the style of a leaderless movement. The lyrics were crowdsourced. It was written online, and you hear it all the time. People march it, people sing it, people sing it at night. And it's become really foundational. Today I caught up with Johnson Yeung Ching Yin, who was one of our earlier guests, and he's a really keen observer of the dynamics of the movement. And I asked him what he thought had changed.
So I think in terms of the nature of the movement, it doesn't change a lot. It's still a democratic movement. Of course, the demands has changed. Some of the dynamics between the protesters and the government has changed. Like, the government withdraw the bill, but then most of the people are not trusting the government and also the police, so the dynamics is changing. And I guess another element that is, you can say, worrying me is the uncertainties of the movement. So now the police are escalating their violence. They shot, not just they shot a school kid yesterday at the National Day, they fired 5 more shots in different locations. So it's quite clear that they are authorized to use live round now. So this is one uncertainty that I cannot foresee. And secondly, another certainty is whether people are patient enough to continue to participate into the movement. Because civil rights movement or civil resistance, it might take a long time. But if people are not patient, they might make mistakes.
I sat in court this morning and I saw the start of 96 people standing trial or being charged with rioting, which could carry sentences of up to 10 years. So that's something else that's changed as well. We're seeing these very long, very punitive sentences being handed down and to large numbers of people. Is that going to deter people?
Now, the bigger elephant in the room is with so many people charged by the police and prosecuted in and be sent on trial, do Hong Kong people have a support network that can support these people, both lawyers and also their family members?
Because we're talking about something like 1,700 arrests since the movement began.
And that number is rising. As the protest continues, more people will be arrested. Right now we have almost 300 people prosecuted, but that number will continue to rise. And do we have enough volunteers, lawyers? Do we have a support network that can take care of the well-being of both the defendants and their family members? That's something we need to consider. But I still have faith that people would manage to get this support network working.
Now, you said the demands of the movement have changed. And it seems to me there's another element that is coming out, which is this Hong Kong nation, you know, with a national anthem. And the kind of things people are chanting, the kind of graffiti that you see everywhere. I mean, how has that happened?
So in the process of nation building, stories of a common struggle or stories of a common enemies and how a groups of people trying to fight for a vision, fight for their dreams, fight against their oppressor is always the element of a nation. According to a public survey, most of the young people under the age of 35 don't associate themselves as Chinese citizens. And when this divergence between the Hong Kong people and also China continues to widen, there will be a point which people think, okay, shall we become a separate political entity? And I do think we are heading to this way. And if the police brutality continues, if China keep on oppressing the people in Hong Kong, it's also legitimate for people to want to separate themselves from mainland China.
But is this something that can even be discussed in the current context? Because when these political parties that advocated autonomy or localism or discussed independence, they were all banned. People who publicly talked about these things have been jailed in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
So how can this discussion be carried out?
The discussions will be carried out in daily life. So when people are starting to diverge from China, they wouldn't just talk about it on mass media or talk about it in the Legislative Council. They would behave differently in their daily life, like rejecting ideas from China, rejecting people from China. That's not something you can suppress simply by outlawing some organization. Secondly, it's not a normative idea or a normative discussions of whether Hong Kong people should separate themselves from mainland China. It's just in nature, it is happening because of the oppression. For East Timor or for Bangladesh, people didn't discuss like for 20 years and suddenly decide they are going to separate from India or Indonesia. It happened because during those 20 years, 30 years, people were discriminated, people were isolated, people were marginalized by a nation who claimed itself as, you know, treating its citizens fairly.
And you're right, it is happening in daily life. I mean, we see the Chinese businesses targeted for graffiti. We're seeing boycotts against Chinese state enterprises. And you're saying this is part of a larger sort of political movement.
Yeah, so the rejections of Chinese bank or brands or allies or, you know, bakery that is associated with China, it didn't start with the ideas of nationalism. It started with a strategic discussions about how should the Hong Kong movement pressure the Chinese government.
So, I mean, what next for Hong Kong? A lot of people have talked about Northern Ireland and an occupation. Is that the way Hong Kong is heading?
I think there are so many scenarios that we cannot foresee, but a ideal scenario is the movement of Hong Kong will continue. Yes, it is going to be a very bumpy journey, which maybe a lot of people will be arrested and prosecuted, but the peoples of Hong Kong would still continue to participate in movement in every front, like not just on the street protesting against the police and also the government, but also doing boycotting, also building organization, also working in their community to build foundation for another round of protests. So I think this is like the ideal scenario.
I mean, that's almost like a war of resistance.
It is going to be a long-term struggle for Hong Kong people, because the state power of China is huge right now, but it wouldn't be able to maintain that level of strength forever. So if the movement continue to survive in Hong Kong, there will be more opportunities for us. You know, for a successful civil resistance movement, it takes multiple runs, multiple cycles of protests.
That was Johnson Yang Qingyin. My final stop today was to talk to a scholar, to an academic, about what this kind of identity politics, what this means for the movement. His name is Brian Fong. He's at the Education University of Hong Kong, and he's a political scientist who's written a lot about Hong Kong identity and nationalism. And he argues that Hong Kong is a stateless nation within a nationless state. If you take stateless nation to be a political community that lacks a state of its own, but self-identifies as a distinct people with enough cohesion to seek some kind of greater self-government. And when we talked, I asked him how this applied to the movement.
I think it's completely correct to say that the movement now was begun because of the extradition bill, but now it's kept being gradually transformed into some forms of autonomous movement. I fully agree with that observation. And here we need to look at the process of the extradition bill legislation a few months ago. Why people, Hong Kong people, react so strongly? Because over the past few months, the Hong Kong government tried to push forward the extradition bill in a very aggressive way. They basically bypassed all the consultative procedures. They bypassed the Legislative Council. They basically forced all the pro-Beijing legislators to cast supporting votes immediately. So the whole process itself, for me, is a very important lesson to the people of Hong Kong. The lesson is, we do not have our own autonomous government and legislature to represent us. The government is just working for the interests of Beijing. When there is a clear instructions and preference from Beijing to pass this bill, the government simply bypassed all the established procedures in order to get things done. So it showed to the people of Hong Kong that the neck of democracy and universal suffrage is really a big problem. So it's somehow dramatically triggered Hong Kong people's demands for autonomy, for democracy, because we want to have a government and a legislature that can protect us, that can represent our interests, and that can defend our identity.
When you hear these people in the movement talking about autonomy, do they mean independence or not? Or do you think they even know what they mean? They just want more ability to decide things themselves?
I think the majority views of the people of Hong Kong, when they talk about autonomy, means greater degree of self-government, particularly in terms of the implementations of universal suffrage. According to my poll, the survey that I conduct, over 80% of the Hong Kong people, they are satisfied with either lower degree or higher degree of autonomy, self-government. Just 3%, around 3% of people will choose independence. So I would say, at least at this moment, I think, most of the Hong Kong people will be satisfied if Beijing is going to offer Hong Kong people a reasonable universal suffrage model that allows Hong Kong people to freely choose our government and legislators. But of course, if Beijing continue to refuse to do so, then people who are dissatisfied, people who are losing hope, may very easily to turn to fighting for independence.
Given what we've seen in the last 3 months, given the change in the dynamics of the movement and the demands of the movement, and then the response, particularly kind of quite brutal response from the Hong Kong police, is that pushing this movement onto a collision course with China?
I think the Chinese government or the Hong Kong government response are very complicated. We must interpret their response in a wider geopolitical context. I think China rely on Hong Kong's international financial center very much, because Hong Kong is the only financial center that can bring in lots of foreign capital to China. For example, 70% of China FDI come from Hong Kong. So for China to completely destroy one country, two system, or to send the PLA to Hong Kong to very violently kill all the Hong Kong people is not something in their own regime interest. Because to do so, it will completely destroy one country, two system, it will completely destroy Hong Kong International Financial Center. Then not just Hong Kong people will suffer. China perhaps will suffer most. So that's why China still restrains from very violently suppressing the movement over the past few months.
But
so the only way forward for China, if they cannot use PLA, if they cannot kill all the people, but on the other hand, they don't want to make compromise. They don't want to give Hong Kong people greater democracy. Then the only way forward is to strengthen police suppression, turning Hong Kong into some forms of quasi-police state, so as to suppress, so as to frighten people from taking part in the movement anymore. That's exactly what we experienced over the past few months. And we don't know whether it will work finally, because the movement is still in the process. But at least over the past few months, it seems that this strategy, transforming Hong Kong into quasi-police state, is not very effective, because people keep fighting. The movement remains very resilient despite of the violent suppressions from the police. The local support is very strong. International support is very strong. All these things makes the movement still have enough momentum, at least to resist the existing level of police violence. Sooner or later, Beijing needs to make a judgment whether to step up the suppression or whether to make concession.
But from your perspective as a scholar of identity and of nationalism, to use this quasi-police state method, what impact does that have on people's collective identity? What impact does it have on themselves, their sense of a Hong Kong nation?
I think all kinds of suppressions, no matter from police or whatever, it will only help consolidate and strengthen Hong Kong girl nationalism. Because nationalism, unless you can completely eliminate, otherwise, suppressions in the long run will only consolidate nationalism. It will only strengthen it in the long run. So every weekend, when there are different incidents showing the police violence, every time there is more people have been hurt, more people have been hit, we can observe that the reactions of Hong Kong people is to continue to resist. Unless Beijing is willing to pay the price to kill all the Hong Kong people, I don't think Hong Kong nationalism will be gone. Let's look at the historical example of Catalans under the Franco regime. Under the Franco regime.
In Spain.
Catalonia has been put under the Franco military rule for several decades. At that time, the Catalans, they have been prohibited from using their own language. Their leaders have been killed, imprisoned, or exiled, and lots of people die. But it doesn't kill the Catalonian nationalism. Spain, once Franco died, once Spain started to move towards democratization in 1979, the Catalonia nationalism come back very strongly. Over a million of Catalan people, they rise to the streets to fight for their autonomy. So that is the lesson that we can draw from history. Nationalism itself is quite interesting. Once they exist, it is very difficult to eliminate. Once they exist, it has very strong momentum to continue itself. Once it exists, it will only grow despite of all kinds of suppression.
It's 3:30 p.m. Hong Kong time on the 4th of October, and we have some breaking news from Hong Kong. Louisa, what's happened?
Hi, Graham. Well, the chief executive, flanked by all her ministers, has just given a press conference. Actually, she's still giving it, where she announced that she is invoking the Emergency Regulations Ordinance, this little-known colonial legislation. And she, starting from midnight, is going to use this to ban people from wearing face masks. And those found to violate that ban could face a fine of $3,000 and a year in prison. People who refuse to remove face masks in illegal assemblies and unauthorized demonstrations could face 6 months in jail and a fine of about $1,000. Let's hear what she had to say.
As the current situation has clearly given rise to a state of serious public danger, the chief executive in council decided at a special meeting this morning to invoke the power under the Emergency Regulations Ordinance and make a new regulation in the name of Prohibition on Face Covering Regulation, which is essentially an anti-mask law, something which has already been introduced in a number of jurisdictions around the world and discussed here in Hong Kong. We believe that the new law will create a deterrent effect against masked violent protesters and rioters, and will assist the police in its law enforcement. The Secretary for Security will later explain in greater details the provisions, and the Secretary for Justice will speak on the legal matters. I would like to emphasize that the decision to invoke the Emergency Regulations Ordinance is a difficult but also a necessary one for public interest.
So, Louisa, it's quite extraordinary what she's proposing to do. What are the chances of this strategy working?
I think the chances of this strategy working are exceedingly low. We've already seen large public demonstrations of people coming out preemptively protesting against this by wearing face masks. And Hong Kong people, you can hear from that mood of defiance that they will not be cowed. There was also interesting constitutional questions as well. This ordinance, it was introduced in the 1920s. It hasn't been used since the riots in 1967. And using these emergency powers means the chief executive can bypass the legislature. The same ordinance can be used to do all kinds of other things. For example, censoring newspapers, suspending public transport, deporting people and suspending all kinds of rights. So it underlines, I think, just how limited the Hong Kong government feels that it is. It's interesting they'd rather suspend civil liberties than make any political concessions. The timing, I think, is also very telling, just after she's returned from Beijing. So I think this is an extremely serious mood. I think it will raise constitutional questions, and I think it'll increase the public unrest. I think we'll see more confrontations ahead.
I mean, the optics are terrible, but I mean, how far are we from full-blown martial law here?
I mean, my view is that what we have already been seeing for the past few days is a kind of de facto martial law. We're already seeing the use of these colonial-era public order ordinances to stop protests by calling them unauthorized assemblies. We're already seeing transport networks being suspended at will. And we're also already seeing what's effectively a de facto curfew. And so I think this goes, one step further down the path of a de facto martial law, even though it's not being called that. And I would say she did say in her press conference that her exact words are that Hong Kong is not in a state of emergency, but I think for the people of Hong Kong, it increasingly feels like it is already in a state of emergency and has been for some time.
Extraordinary. Louisa, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Graham.
You've been listening to the Little Red Podcast, bringing you China from beyond the Beijing Beltway. Thanks to our guests, Wong Yik Mo, Fernando Chung, Johnson Jung, and Brian Fong. We're on air thanks to support from the Australian Centre on China in the World and the ANU's Department of Pacific Affairs. Our editor is Andy Hazel, background research by Julia Bergen. Our fabulous interns are Gil Ricci and Noah Yim. Our moody background music is by Susie Wilkins, and our cartoons GIFs are courtesy of Seb Danta. Bye for now.